So we can get started?
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you so much to the Language Campus here at the University of Jyväskylä for the opportunity to speak today about demystifying machine translation and improving machine translation literacy. My name is Lynn Bauker, and my regular job is as a professor at the School of Translation and Interpretation at the University of Ottawa in Canada. But for the months of November and December, I'm being hosted as a visiting fellow here at the University of Jyväskylä. So I'm going to divide today's talk into two main parts. The first thing that I'm going to do is a little bit of a crash course to demystify machine translation and talk a little bit about what is neural machine translation, or how do data-driven approaches to machine translation work, what is algorithmic bias, and a little bit of human-computer interaction. And essentially, this is a sort of crash course in machine translation literacy. So I thought I'd do that first, and then afterwards, when you understand what a course in machine translation literacy might look like, or at least a trimmed down version, then we can talk more about how you might like to participate in the teaching of machine translation literacy to others, whether they're your students or whether you work with other groups that might benefit from machine translation literacy instruction, like teens or newcomers to a country or other people that you might encounter. So those will be the two kind of halves of the talk, and we can take questions after each half if that sort of makes sense. So if you have questions, pop them in the chat and we can address them at the end of each half of the talk. Okay, so for demystifying machine translation, when we talk about machine translation, we are really talking about that category or type of tool that automatically translates text from one language, such as French, into another language, such as English. And it's a little bit up to you whether you ask the tool to translate just a word for you, a whole sentence, maybe a longer text. But the point is that whatever text you offer to the machine, it will translate the whole thing for you with really no intervention on your part. So in that way, it's different from other types of tools that you might have used, like electronic dictionaries or concordancers or translation memory tools. Those are all kind of more in the category of computer-assisted translation. They do some of the work for you, but there's a lot of interaction between you and the tool. Machine translation, there can be some interaction, usually either before or after the translation process, but the translation process itself is carried out automatically. So, of course, one of the best known examples of a machine translation tool is Google Translate. This is one that probably almost everyone has heard of. So that's the type of tool that we're talking about. You might wonder why we talk about machine translation and not computer translation. And this is really just a kind of a throwback term. Machine translation technology is much older than people might realize. We've sort of encountered it in our daily lives only in the past 10 to 15 years, since tools like Google Translate became free online tools. But the technology itself goes back much further, back to the post-Second World War period. That's when computers were just emerging. And when people talked about developing applications, machine translation was ironically one of the first things that they tried to do. So back at that time, you can see that computers were really machines. They were gigantic. They filled an entire room. They had all kinds of tubes and wires. And so at that time, we talked about computing machines. And so machine translation is, as a term, really just a kind of throwback to that period. Even though now, of course, when we talk about computing machines, we talk about computers. But just to make that distinction that I opened with, that machine translation is fully automatic and computer-aided translation is other types of tools that are used by translators, but that require assistance from translators to be used effectively. Okay. Another really important thing to realize is that machine translation is a category of tools. It's not a single tool. Of course, Google Translate is very well known. It's very widely used. A recent estimate was that there are over 1 billion users of Google Translate, machine translation tool. But of course, it's not the only one. There are a whole host of others. These are, this is also not a comprehensive list, but just some examples of other tools that are in the same category. So all of these are machine translation tools. And this is sometimes worth keeping in mind, because even if our first instinct is to go to Google, we should realize that just like any other type of product, different tools have different strengths. So if we think of other types of products like cars, you know, perhaps you are a fan of Nissan or of Ford or of, you know, another brand of car because it has certain features that you like. Well, machine translation is a little bit similar. You might find that different tools perform better or worse depending on the task that you have in mind, or the language combination that you work with, or the subject field that you're translating. So all of the tools that I've listed here are free and online, and you know, some of their different characteristics. So Google certainly has the widest range of languages available, including quite a few less widely used languages. So if you are someone working with a language pair that is not very widely used, you might have a better chance of finding that pair handled by Google than by some other tools. Bing Microsoft Translator is an example that I like to point out because it offers different varieties of some languages. So in terms of French, for example, you could actually choose to translate into the Canadian version of French or other versions of French. So that's kind of a nice option for people who are users of a particular variety of a language. DeepL is another tool that is becoming very popular and has possibly got the highest quality for many Western European languages. It doesn't do as many languages as Google, but the ones that it does quite well. So on the whole, DeepL is known as being a high quality tool. Papago is a tool that is strong for language like Korean, Baidu for Chinese, Yandex tends to be very strong for Eastern European languages. So again, it makes sense to pick your machine translation tool based on your immediate needs and to realize that while Google might do the job, it's also not the only option out there, because I think sometimes we forget to look beyond the obvious. So there are a whole host of tools out there to choose from. Okay, so my advice with regard to translation tools is that, you know, why not try more than one? If you're not happy with the results that you're getting from a particular tool, whether it's Google or another tool, you know, they are free, they're easily available. So why not try another? And you might be happier with the results that you get from another tool. And it's also important to remember that these tools are under active development, so they are changing all the time. If you're disappointed with the results that you get from a tool on a particular occasion, don't write it off completely and say, well, I'm never going to use that tool again. It did such a disastrous job. Maybe the text that you were working with wasn't well suited to the language combination offered by the tool or the you know, kind of text type. But each translation job is different. So don't completely give up on a tool because you had one bad experience. So a little bit of trial and error, I think, will help you figure out which tool works best for you, the types of text that you normally work with. And just like any other type of tool, you know, a tool that's good for one job might not be the right tool for the next job. So get into the habit of really evaluating every time you have a translation task to do, you know, which tool will be best suited for the task at hand. Okay. So it kind of raises the question a little bit, how does machine translation work and why don't we get the same results from all tools? If I'm here recommending to you that you should try different tools with the same text, that is because you'll get different results with each tool that you try. And why is that? Why do we get different results from different machine translation systems? And the reason is sort of because how these tools work today. So in the past, when I talked about, just after the Second World War, when we were just starting to develop machine translation systems, the approach that was taken at that time was very much based on linguistics. The developers of the tools thought that if they could build a big enough dictionary, and if they could encode grammatical rules about how to put different words together, then they would be able to solve the problem of machine translation. So they put their efforts into that, what's called a rule-based approach, where they were encoding painstakingly all the grammar rules for all the different languages and all the different combinations of languages and building gigantic dictionaries. And they had limited success, but it was definitely limited. We look back now at the quality produced by the early machine translation systems, and we sort of think, well, that's sort of disappointing. It wasn't that good. And it's ironic, as I said, that they chose to start with machine translation as one of the earliest applications of computers, because translation is actually a very difficult task. And so it was a sort of strange decision to sort of go for one of the hardest tasks right at the beginning. But eventually, what they realized was perhaps there's a better way. Instead of trying to make computers process language in a way that's similar to how people process language, maybe we could let the computers do what they're good at instead. And so what we see now is a really sharp turn towards, since about the year, about the turn of the millennium, we've seen a completely different approach to machine translation. Instead of looking at linguistic rules and repositories of lexicon, we are in an era now where we're taking a data-driven approach to machine translation, and it's a completely different way to approach the problem than the rule-based approach or than how people actually process language. So let's look a little bit about why the early systems didn't work so well. And this is a slide that my son says is disturbing, but I hope I'll be able to explain it to you. If we are comparing the way that language processing takes place in people versus computers, one of the really important things that we need to realize is that people don't just use grammar and dictionaries. We actually use a lot of our real-world knowledge to interpret a text. We use context. And so here's a simple example. In French, the word avocat can have two meanings. So it can be translated from French into English either as lawyer or as avocado. So those are two potential, possible, and entirely legitimate translations of the word avocat. We can translate it as lawyer or as avocado. So as a person, you're probably not going to be find it very difficult to make the choice, right? The context will tell you pretty clearly whether the correct translation is avocado or whether it's lawyer. And we do this by having, a little bit of real world knowledge, like lawyers are people and we don't eat people, or avocados are inanimate kind of food and they can't go to court and make an argument. So, we actually take, not even a millisecond probably to process that information just because we know how the world works. But if we give the same text to a machine translation system, like j'ai mangé un avocat, we might actually get a translation such as I ate a lawyer, because lawyer's in the dictionary and it doesn't have any real world knowledge. So it really, kind of hit a wall, this what they call the semantic barrier, this rule-based approach to machine translation. And so now we actually have turned the whole process upside down and said, computers are not good at real-world knowledge. They don't have any. And so what can we ask them to do that they might be good at instead? So some of the greatest strengths of computers are not real-world knowledge, but things like number crunching and pattern matching. And these are actually superpowers of computers. They can process so many numbers so quickly, it would make our head spin. And they are relentless in finding every instance of a pattern. If you give it a gigantic corpus of billions of words and you ask it to find all the examples of a particular word, it can do that very quickly in the blink of an eye, whereas it would take you or I years to read through billions of words of text. So we definitely have some strengths, but computers have their strengths too. The point is they're very different. So we can't approach translation the same way with a computer as we would tackle that task ourselves. So the very most recent and current approach to machine translation is what we call a data-driven approach. So it's playing to those strengths of computers. It's allowing the computers to have access to and to process large amounts of data, because that's one of the things that computers are really good at. So the most current approach is known as neural machine translation. And it uses artificial intelligence techniques. So it has artificial neural networks. You can see a little diagram here of a neural network, which is a network that takes some input. So the light green nodes on the left are the input. Then in the middle, in light blue, it shows that the computer's doing some kind of processing, and it will output something which is shown in yellow on the other side. Now, this particular example of a neural network has just one processing layer in the middle. A neural network can have many, many layers. And it's a little bit of a black box what happens in there. It's some kind of mathematical stuff. And it's not essential for us to understand exactly what's happening inside the neural network in order for us to appreciate some of the more general ways in which machine translation works. So don't worry if you don't understand all of the kind of gory details of a neural network. It's enough to realize that it's a data-driven approach and that it takes input data in the form of training data, and it will produce a sort of proposed translation for you at the end of the task. Now, the thing that is really important, though, to understand is that as input data on the left, the data-driven machine translation systems don't just need one or two examples, and they don't just need like 100 or 1,000 examples. In order to work, they really need millions and millions of examples. So we're talking about gigantic corpora, and at the bottom of the screen, you can see sort of just a very small example of a parallel corpus. So it's a corpus where we have a text in one language and its translation into another language, and these are aligned, so usually at a sentence level, so that it's a clear example for the machine that if you encounter a text like this sentence, it might look like that in another language. So if we are giving millions and millions of examples to a machine translation system, it can learn from them. It's a sort of artificial learning, but it can learn from them, and it can learn what seems to be a likely or reasonable translation based on all of the examples that it has seen. The challenge with data-driven approaches, though, is that these approaches are also sensitive to data. And that means that on the one hand, yes, we need many, many examples, but that's not enough. We can't just take lots and lots of text, grab whatever we find, and just throw it into a big pot. We need to put a little bit of care into the choice of the texts, because in addition to needing lots of data, we need the right kind of data. And in translation, this could mean that you need the right languages, obviously. If you want to train a machine translation system to translate from Finnish into English, well, it doesn't make a lot of sense to give it information in Arabic and Spanish, right? So you have to, of course, have the right languages. But even more than that, you might like to think about having the right subject matter content. If you want your system to translate medical texts, then it doesn't make a lot of sense to train it with legal texts or some other domain. And so what we're finding in this data-driven world, this data-driven approach to machine translation, is that finding the right kind of data can be a bit of a challenge. And it's led us to a situation that gets described as kind of high resource languages and low resource languages. So high resource languages could mean languages that are very widely spoken. So English is a language that is very widely spoken around the world. So it's not that hard to find data in English. If we want to talk about language pairs, we might say, well, English and French is a high resource language pair because individually, both English and French are widely spoken. And there are many contexts where texts are translated between those languages. We think of Canada, which has English and French as official languages. Within the European Union, English and French both are official languages. So we're not challenged too much when it comes to finding resources that we could use as examples to feed these machine translation systems. When we get into languages that are less widely used, so I'm here in Finland at the moment, and Finnish is a language that is the national language of Finland, but it's not widely spoken anywhere else in the world. So it's not a high resource language. And if we were to think about translating between Finnish and another language that's not highly used, then we have not only two individual languages that are less widely used, but the translations between them might be difficult to obtain as well. So maybe like Finnish and Greek, maybe there's not a lot of examples available, readily available between those two languages. So that means that the machine translation systems for the high resource languages tend to produce better quality because they have more examples to look at. And the machine translation between language pairs that are less widely used might have fewer examples to draw from and then not be producing quite as high quality. It gets even more complicated then when we want to translate very specialized domains, because the same thing happens. Some domains are very common, or we find translation between them. So topics that are widely talked about in governments tend to have a lot of corpus resources available. So we might see, you know, in the European Union or again, the Canadian government, whatever the governments are talking about, we have examples of. But the governments don't talk about everything, or they have their own particular variety of language, the sort of bureaucratic administrative language. And it may be less easy to find very technical texts, for example, to put in our corpora. So when we're dealing with a combination of potentially less widely used languages and less common domains, all of a sudden, it's quite challenging to come up with billions of examples. And so this has created a situation where machine translation works better for some languages and topics than for others. Something else that we need to keep in mind is this concept of algorithmic bias. So we might say that a neural machine translation system is a little bit like a baby when it starts out. It's like a baby, it doesn't know anything. And what it's going to learn is what we teach it. So we have to be careful about what we teach it, right? Just like we have to maybe be careful, like we don't swear in front of our children, or you know, we don't talk about certain topics in front of our children. We have to think about the machine translation system as being a system that's going to learn what we teach it. So if the training data is not well chosen, if it contains language that we might consider to be sexist or racist, then the machine translation system can potentially learn this and replicate it. So I've got some examples, and maybe you can tell me if the translation is correct, but I understand that in Finnish, there's a sort of gender neutral pronoun. So the pronoun doesn't take a he or she the way that we would have to make that decision in English. So when translating from Finnish into English, the system has to make a choice. So in a data-driven system, it's going to make a choice by what it usually sees, what is more typical, what has it learned from the corpus that it has been given. And we can see here that it's making very different choices between he and she, depending on what comes next. So he is a leader, but she has a grandchild. He works and she's taking care of the child. So it's turning out language that we, you know, that it's, there's no reason that it should have chosen he or she, except that that's the examples that it has seen. So it's a problem which is called algorithmic bias or machine bias. But the problem is not really with the tool or the technology, it's with the data. And the data has been created by people. So people are the problem in this scenario. We are a society, maybe, that doesn't reflect the ideals of having, you know, no sexism and no racism. And because our texts reflect our society, the machine learns from the text that we provide it. And so it basically means that we need to work on ourselves and work on our own social issues. But it underscores the point that it's important to pick the training data carefully because the machine will learn what it's taught. Okay. Something else that I think we need to be aware of when we're using machine translation is that one of our main jobs is to conduct a little bit of risk assessment. When we decide to use a machine translation tool or not, we should take into account the situation that we're in and the reason that we're using the tool. Because some situations are more what we might consider high stakes than others, meaning the consequences of getting it wrong could be quite serious in some cases, whereas in other contexts, it's really not a big deal if the translation isn't so good. So we can think of contexts such as, you know, visiting a doctor for a health problem. The stakes of having a bad translation in the context of healthcare are more serious than in a context such as, you know, translating a manga comic for entertainment, right? If the translation of your manga comic is terrible, you might be disappointed, but you're not going to, you know, suffer any serious consequences from that. So this is something that I think is, again, it's not really about the tool itself, but it's about our judgment. It's about learning to evaluate what's a good context for using machine translation and what's a less good context. Now, sometimes, of course, we also are faced with the situation where, well, is a potentially poor or a potentially less than perfect translation still better than no translation at all? And that's where we get into making a very difficult decision. So sometimes we would say, let's give machine translation a try because the alternative is no translation, and that's certainly not helpful at all. So I'm going to come in a second to talk about another issue, which is transparency. If we are using machine translation in a situation where we're saying, okay, we have no choice because the alternative is nothing, it's important, I think, still to socialize the idea for people that it is a machine translation, because that allows them to assess their own kind of risk tolerance for trusting the information that they're being presented with. So transparency is another kind of issue that goes along with the risk assessment idea. I'll just mention at the end of the slide, a little sort of warning that when you're using free and online machine translation tools, such as Google Translate, but Google Translate is not the only one, when you're using a free online machine translation, usually the terms and conditions of using that tool include that they may keep your data and do other things with your data. Like maybe they'll use it for more training or, you know, for some other purpose that they have. So it's a good idea not to put confidential information into an online machine translation tool. Now, you might think that when you close the window, it just disappears, but it doesn't disappear. Google has your information now, and they can use it according to the terms and conditions that they've laid out, which none of us ever read. So we just have to be a little bit careful. Don't put your banking information into an online machine translation tool. Don't put really personal information that you don't want to be out in the world, because it could be out in the world once you've put it in a free online machine translation tool. Okay. I wanted to raise the very specific question, because we're here in a university context and I work at a university context back in Canada. A question that's getting asked a lot is, can I use machine translation for my coursework? Where does that fall in the risk assessment of things? And it's a little bit of a gray area, I think. Students are using machine translation. Many language teachers wish that they wouldn't use machine translation, but where do we kind of lie on this spectrum? And one of the things that I've started to do is sort of to say, well, what is the learning objective of the course? Not all courses have the same learning objective. So maybe you are an international student. You've come from another country to Finland to study, and you are here studying science, for example. And so the objective of your science course is to learn science. That's the point of your science course, right? To learn the subject matter of science. And so if you are using machine translation because you have to hand your work in Finnish or in English, and that's not the language that you normally speak, you might say, well, I'm using it because I want to, you know, I want to submit my work to my professor. I've learned the concepts of science, and I just need some help expressing them. So to my mind, this is a very different objective than being in a language course, where in the language course, the objective is to learn the language, so maybe French. And so I think that it's, you know, a question of what is the purpose of the course, and, you know, certainly how does the teacher feel about it? But in either case, I think what we're doing is trying to use machine translation as a sort of writing aid rather than necessarily as something that will do the whole translation task for us. So if you're the science student and you're just trying to hand in your work in English and demonstrate that you have an understanding of the concepts, one of the things that you need to work on is writing your source text very, very well. So you're writing the source text in your own language, but you know, this is an obvious thing to translators, but less obvious to people who aren't translators. If your source text is badly written, the translation is going to be a disaster. So you have to really work on creating a good source text in your own language in order for it to be well translated into another language. So this is actually helping you, I think, to kind of learn the concepts and learn, you know, the learning objectives of the course is to learn science. So you have to learn to write science really well in your own language in order to be able to benefit from machine translation. And hopefully machine translation is, you know, something, a tool that you will become less reliant on over time, but I don't think that goes against the objectives of the course. In a language learning, what I usually advise students is to try it yourself first and use the machine translation more as a verification tool. So see how you would do it, and then you can compare your results to a machine translation tool and treat it as a writing aid rather than as you offloading the entire task onto a machine translation system. Either way, though, I think it's important to be respectful of your teacher's instructions. If they absolutely do not want you to use it, then you should respect what they've asked of you. What I try to do now is say to my students, I'm going to let you use machine translation for many different activities because it's out there. Professionals are using it. It seems silly not to. It seems silly not to learn how to use it and work well with it. On occasion, there may be something I want you to learn, and I would appreciate that you not use machine translation right away. And so I think the students are more receptive to that because it's not outright forbidden, and they know that if I'm asking them not to use it for a particular task, that I have a well thought out reason. So rather than a blanket kind of policy, yes or no. It's a sort of, it depends on what we're doing. but I do ask students always to be transparent. So if you used machine translation for your assignment, put it, tell me which tool you used, tell me which parts of the text you used it for, and show me clearly how you were able to improve it, because chances are it can be improved. Even if you are using it to get the gist of something, chances are that you as a translator trainee or a language student are going to be able to recommend some ways of improving it, because we just do have operate on a different level. And of course, if you're using it in an essay to take the ideas that you found in another paper, you still need to cite those ideas, even if you're changing the language in which they're being expressed. Okay, translating something doesn't absolve you of the need to attribute properly through referencing and citation. So those are some questions that have come up in my kind of language teaching environment. And so that's sort of the advice that I'm giving, but it'll be interesting to have a discussion and see what others are doing or what other ideas people have. Mostly though, I would say that, forbidding it doesn't work. In fact, it sort of makes it more enticing. And so I don't think it makes a lot of sense to forbid machine translation at this point. It's here and it's not going away. The students are using it, whether we think they should or not. So I see my responsibility as helping them use it in a smarter way rather than trying to kind of lock down the use of machine translation. Okay, so that's the end of kind of the crash course in machine translation literacy part. So I wonder if it makes sense to take, if there's any questions on that part, to take them now, and then I'll talk a little bit more about my teaching experience in the second part. Do we have any idea where Google and other machine translation companies get their parallel corpora from? Yes, I would say that they get it from a wide variety of sources. Probably they do a lot of what we might describe as scraping from the internet of anything that is sort of in the free domain. So many of the European Union and the Canadian government websites are multilingual, for example. Lots of international or multinational companies would be multilingual, have their websites in different languages. So I suspect that there's a lot of scraping of data from existing free domain sites, but also everything that gets entered into the Google machine translation system and translated is probably captured and stored and used at a further level of training. So the more we use the systems, we're actually generating data for them. And you may have noticed that some of the tools actually give you the option of editing a little bit, improving the translation. So they love to see that as well, because you're kind of doing some work for them in making the translations better. And so, yeah, it's a little bit of a cycle that feeds itself to some extent.
Mm-hmm. And there's a comment, but that means that they might be sourcing from websites and other materials translated by the automatic machine itself.
Exactly. Yes, that's what I mean. It's a sort of feeding itself a little bit. Some of the most active and current area of machine translation research is on what they call synthetic data. So it's data that's a little bit artificial. So it could mean that it was translated by a machine itself or generated somehow through another type of AI tool. So absolutely, yes, what we're seeing is that machine translation is being trained with machine translation data. Yeah, to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, so the next part of the talk that I'd like to share with you is a little bit about my experience of trying to develop and teach machine translation literacy to people who are not translators or even necessarily language students or having a strong background in formal language learning. Okay. So when I talk about machine translation literacy, what I'm really trying to describe is a sort of type of digital plus information literacy that focuses on developing critical thinking skills rather than technical competence, right? So it's not really about how to use machine translation in the sense of which button do I push, because really the technology is super simple, right? It's sort of like copy, paste, click, and that's all there is to using it technically, unlike some other types of software, which are very sophisticated and really require a lot of effort to learn how to use them and a gigantic user manual that you have to read. Machine translation as a user is a very simple software to use. So it's not about how, you know, to learn which button to push, but it's really about making decisions such as, you know, should I be using machine translation in this context? What are the consequences of using it in this context? What might I use instead of machine translation? Or, you know, should I use machine translation this time, but not next time? So it's really about this sort of cognitive thinking that goes around machine translation use rather than the technical side of it. We might also think about how we as people could interact with the machine translation system to improve the output. And as I said, sometimes that interaction might be before we give a text to the machine translation system. Sometimes it might be taking the output of the machine translation system and trying to make it better before we use it for a certain purpose. So what is our role in the process and how can we work together with the machine? And so by asking this type of question, we sort of have the potential to become more informed and more critical users instead of just doing this autopilot where we copy, paste, click, done, next. But I do have to say that, you know, when I first started thinking about machine translation literacy, I sort of thought of it as one concept. But now I realize the vastly different types of users who are out there and the different purposes that they might have for using machine translation. Now I see machine translation literacy as much more of a kind of customizable concept. Language students might need different information about machine translation than you know, people who are using it for leisure purposes versus people who are trying to use it in their workplace. So machine translation literacy, just like machine translation use, might look different. So I'm talking about my experience today, which is mostly working with students at universities, but students who are not translation students. So that's my context, but you might want to adjust machine translation literacy a little bit depending on the type of people that you're working with. Okay. So firstly, what's driving the need for machine translation literacy? Why are we even talking about this here today? And of course, one reason I've already alluded to briefly is that machine translation is now out there, right? For many years, starting from the time during the post-Second World War up to around the year 2000 or even 2005, machine translation wasn't freely available. It wasn't easy to get your hands on it. It was only researchers and developers and maybe professional translators that had access to this technology. But in the last 15 years, that has been turned upside down completely by tools like Google Translate. Now, anyone can get their hands on machine translation. All you need is an internet connection and you've got machine translation accessible to you. So that's one big change. The second, I see everything is helpfully numbered one here. Sorry about that. The second item is that, again, as I mentioned, machine translation is very easy to use. And in some ways, it's almost too easy because when something is super easy to do, we don't think about it. We just do it at like on autopilot. So the fact that it's so simple to use puts us in a risky situation where we don't necessarily take the time to think about whether we should be using it. We've also talked about the data-driven approach to machine translation. And one of the big differences between the output of data-driven approaches to machine translation and those old rule-based approaches to machine translation is that the output of machine translation using data-driven approach sounds good. The older approaches produced really clunky sentences, and it was actually quite easy to tell that it was machine translation because it just sounded weird. Yeah, it sounded clunky, and we might even call it sort of translationese. You know when you're reading a bad translation. It just sounds off. The words might be in the language, but they don't go together well, and it just sounds weird. With data-driven machine translation, it sounds good, even if it's not right. It sounds good, so it lulls us into this false sense of security. It sounds reasonable, so it must be right. And sometimes it's not correct. So it's harder to spot the errors, and the errors are different than what we were used to seeing with the older approaches to machine translation. So that's a challenge. And something else is that the popular media really seems to like talking about machine translation now. It's actually a fairly regular topic in the popular media, but the problem is that the popular media tend to present a sort of binary description of machine translation. Either they are picking on the mistakes and sort of saying that it's terrible, it's a horrible tool, or they're really hyping it up at the other end and saying like, oh, pretty soon we won't even need translators. Like, these are amazing. They're practically magic. And those two extremes are not the reality for most machine translation, which really falls somewhere in the middle. So we have to be a little bit careful about what we read in the popular media, because not always is it the case that the journalist understands the technology. So they're not presenting it necessarily in the best or most nuanced light. Okay. So if all of those things are happening, we don't have background in translation, the tools are really easy to use, the media is telling us that they're amazing or they're terrible, you know, where does this leave people? Why do we think that people should instinctively know how to use machine translation in a smart way? And the answer is that they don't. Why would someone who has no background in translation know how to use a translation tool in a smart way? It's like, I have no background in medicine. Don't let me loose in an operating theater and let me start, like, you know, operating on people. That would be a terrible idea. So why do we think that people who have no background in translation should just know how to use machine translation in a smart way? They don't. And so I feel that we in the language professions or the language industry have a little bit of a social responsibility to help them develop good critical thinking skills around machine translation. So I've started a program of machine translation literacy at my own university. And, you know, it basically looks like the first half of the presentation today, where we talk a little bit about how machine translation works, what are the, you know, kind of implications of a data-driven approach to machine translation, the fact that there are multiple machine translation systems out there that we can try. We talk a little bit about this risk assessment idea, which tasks are high stakes, which are low stakes, and how can we develop good judgment about when to use machine translation. We talk about transparency, that it's important to be honest. If you're using a machine translation tool, you don't need to be ashamed of it. It's not shameful to use machine translation, but you do need to be transparent about it, because that allows the recipient of the translated information to determine their own kind of comfort level in trusting that information. Okay, and we talked a little bit about interacting with machine translation, this idea of garbage in equals garbage out, right? That if you want a good translation, you need to provide a good source text. And that at the other end, you know, the translation that's produced by the machine might not be perfect. And so depending on what you're planning to do with that information, you might need to improve the text. You might need to do some editing or arrange for someone else to do the editing if you can't do it yourself, but it may not be enough to just stop with the raw machine translation output. So this is like kind of the type of thing that I talk about in machine translation literacy. As I said, it's a customizable concept. You might find that the groups that you're working with would benefit from other information, and that's terrific. You might be well placed to determine what that should be. So what I've actually started is to pilot a course on translation for non-translators. And Machine translation literacy is just one part of that. So it's not a 12-week course on machine translation literacy. It's a 12-week course on translation, and machine translation literacy is one module within that. So it's the only module I'm going to talk about today, but I didn't want to give you the impression that the whole 12 weeks is about machine translation. But it's a course that is new at our university anyway, and it's a course that is basically aimed at everyone except people in the professional translation program. So it's a first year course, and it's very open. It has no prerequisites, and students from any other faculty can register to take the course. So we've got students who are coming from the education faculty, from engineering, health sciences, management, science, social science. All in all, so far, this is the fourth iteration of the course. So I first taught it in the fall semester last year. So I'm in the fourth iteration of the course now. And I've seen students from 47 different programs at the university come through. So it's really diverse, the group who's there. And I also asked them to sort of self-declare. We have in Canada, of course, two official languages, French and English, but we get many international students. We have many students who have a heritage language. Maybe they or their parents have immigrated from another country. So we see a diverse range of languages, and I've asked just, you know, students to self-declare what their native or dominant language is, and there have been 28 different languages in the course so far. And so we have seen approximately 200 students have gone through the course so far, and I asked them to do a little survey on the machine translation literacy part of the course, and I've got 170 responses, so around an 85% response rate. So I just want to share with you a little bit what the results of that survey were. And one of the first questions that I ask the students is, how often do you use machine translation? Is it like something that's regular for you or hardly ever? And you can see that, over 80% of the students are using it at least once a month, and many of them are using it much more often than that, sometimes even every day. So they are definitely using the technology. It's not an alien concept to them. It's not something that they, you know, might use once a year. They're using it quite regularly. And they're not translators, right? These students are not translation students. So they're people who are doing and studying other things. And I asked them, you know, in what area of your life do you use machine translation? So, of course, I'm talking to students. It's not terribly surprising that many of them are using it for their coursework, because, you know, that's kind of their what they spend most of their time doing. They're studying, and so they might be using machine translation for their courses. But they also use it. Some of them might have a part-time job outside of their studies, and using it for leisure activities as well. Of their life, they're using machine translation. I was also interested to know whether they use machine translation mostly to kind of absorb information. So they're starting with a text in a language that they don't know and translating it into their own language, or whether they're trying to use machine translation to help them produce information to share with other people. And it seems that most students use it in both directions. So they are using machine translation both to kind of assimilate information from another language, but also to disseminate information. So these are actually two very different tasks, and machine translation may be better or worse for some of those purposes. So it's interesting to know that students are using it mainly in both directions. I also wanted to get a feel for, before they learn anything about, you know, machine translation literacy, how happy are they with machine translation? Do they think that it's working well to meet the needs that they have? And most students are reasonably satisfied. You know, very few are completely satisfied. Very few are completely dissatisfied. Most are coming down somewhere in the middle, either very or moderately satisfied. So that gives me hope that, you know, they could learn something from machine translation literacy and perhaps up their satisfaction level a little bit by learning how to use it. Sometimes it's not that the tool is bad, but that we've used it for the wrong thing or that we haven't shown good judgment around it. So I'm hopeful that this result means that they're not so disappointed in it that they're going to give up on it, but there's room for improvement to be able to use it better, more effectively. A big question I asked them, if there was no free online machine translation system, what would you do instead? And the really interesting thing for me here is that nobody would pay a professional. Now, we are talking about students. Students don't have a lot of money, but the types of needs that students have, they would not pay a professional. And this is really important because in the translation community, I think there's often quite a lot of concern that machine translation is taking away business from professional translators. This group would not be paying professional translators anyway. So there's really no need for sort of a false competition between professional translators and machine translation systems, at least not in the context of students. Most of them said, well, I'd ask a friend to help or a colleague. A couple would translate the text themselves. Quite a few would just do nothing. So it's really not, this use case anyway, is not a threat to professional translation. This is a type of translation where the needs were simply going unmet before. It's not business that's being taken away from translators. I asked them, out of all the different things that we learned in the machine translation literacy module, which one surprised you the most, or what was the most novel thing that you learned that you hadn't expected about machine translation? And the most common one was they were shocked to find out that Google or other translation companies could keep their data. And a lot of students said, oh, I'm going to be a little more careful now about what I enter into the machine translation system. It never occurred to me. Or a lot of students said, it didn't occur to me, but now that you pointed out, I think, yeah, of course they're keeping my data. What was I thinking? But yeah, that was the most common one, but quite a variety, as you see. So that, again, made me think that machine translation literacy is worth it because they are learning different things. Some people knew X, some people knew Y, but nobody knew everything. And almost everyone learned something new in the machine translation literacy module. Okay. And finally, I asked them two questions at the end. I said, you are not a translator. You're not planning to become a translator, but you do use machine translation. Do you think that this module on machine translation literacy, or the concept of machine translation literacy in general, is important for people who are not planning to become language professionals? And most of the students said, yes, it was very important. They really felt that they had learned something and that it would change their approach to using machine translation in the future. Hardly anyone said it wasn't worthwhile. You know, not everyone thought it was super important, but most people thought it was, you know, it was worth learning. They had felt it was time well spent. And the very last question I said was, do you think then, based on your experience, that this, because it's a pilot project at the moment, do you think that we should make this a permanent part of the university's offering and that we should be teaching machine translation literacy to all students, even the ones who aren't planning a career in the language professions? And again, I was really pleasantly surprised by the kind of positive encouragement for doing this, for saying, yes, it does seem to be worthwhile. People who aren't in the language professions are still users of this technology and are perhaps more in need of it because they won't get it, this type of education, anywhere else. So that was the last question in the survey. So just to wrap things up, a sort of takeaway, if I could say anything about machine translation, I would say it is not going, it is here, it's free. It's easy to use. Of course, people are going to use it. They are using it. As I said, a recent estimate from Google themselves was that there are a billion users of this technology. So even if we think, you know, and by we, I mean people in the language professions, think that people outside the language professions shouldn't use this technology, that they should turn to professionals for high quality service instead, it doesn't matter what we think. They are using it. And they're using it often, and they're using it for a variety of purposes. So I think that we should be less concerned about this idea of competing with machine translation. Many of the things that people use it for, they would not have hired a professional translator for anyway. It's not taking away any business. And this point is, I think, also really important. Things that are obvious to translators are not obvious to non-translators. And that goes back to my point, sort of like, well, why would we think that people who don't have a background, a preparation, a training in translation would be able to use this tool in the smartest way possible unless we help them? So I do think that there is a sort of social responsibility on the part of the language professions, because I think we have been guilty a little bit of slamming the technology, saying that it's really not good and you should, you know, you really need to be careful. You should be hiring a professional translator instead. I think that we need to change our tone a little bit and recognize that, you know, we can play a role in helping people and that it's not harming us. Helping others is not harming us. And so I think that maybe we need to think about that a little more. And I'm actually interested in where and when we should be doing machine translation literacy interventions. And I've been working a lot with first-year university students, but it seems to me that it might be worth introducing this to people who are even younger, because they're arriving at university already having used machine translation. So maybe we should be thinking about integrating it into high school or maybe even middle school, I don't know. And to do that, we need to reach an important group, and this is where I'm sort of trying to tackle now, is this idea of teaching the teachers. So we can't necessarily put a translator in every classroom, but if we could get involved in maybe integrating machine translation literacy education into teacher training, then the teachers themselves could carry that forward to the students. And I think that it could be part of a sort of media literacy, digital literacy, information literacy kind of package. And we know that they have those at schools already. We just sort of need to inject a little bit of machine translation literacy into that overall package to reach a much wider, I think, group of the general public. Okay, and I will end there. I will put up just one last slide where people can contact me if you're interested in knowing more about the Machine Translation Literacy Project. We have a website, we're on Twitter, and you can, of course, email me at my home institution. And there's the book, of course, the book I should mention. Yes, I have to say, so I'm attached to a school of translation and interpretation and I'm very much in translator training. So I don't personally do language teaching, but I'm interested in having more conversations with people who do language teaching, because I agree with you. I think there are parallels and I think that we could learn from each other and perhaps reach a wider audience by working together. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really hope that I do think it's something that many groups could participate in. And I really love the language campus setup that you have here, where you bring people together from the language department, but also from education, also people with an interest in technologies. And I do think that this is a kind of interdisciplinary issue, and that we will, you know, do a better job of kind of solving it or tackling it by working together, because I think translation is one facet of it, but it's also about teaching. It's also about kind of, critical development, judgment, which can be honed through other avenues than only through translation. Yeah, I do actually strongly believe in that. I think there's been a sort of false idea of competition between professional translators and machine translation. Partly it developed way back in that period in the following the Second World War. Part of the problem was that at the time, there was nothing like computational linguistics. There was nothing like language technology. At the time, all of the work on machine translation was being done only by those early computer scientists who were often mathematicians or electrical engineers, and they thought that machine translation would be an easy thing for them to solve. They used the model of cryptography from the war, code breaking, and they thought that they could apply code breaking techniques to solving translation. So at the time, the people working on machine translation were perhaps a little bit naive about what was involved because they weren't translators themselves. They didn't know. And so the messaging that went out in the early years was quite destructive, I think. They really overpromised and then underdelivered. And so it left a bad taste, really, in the kind of mouth of a translator to have been told, this technology is going to put you out of business. That was the initial message that came out. And of course, we in the translation professions realize it's much more complex than a code breaking. It's not something that's an easy fix. But it set a bad tone right from the beginning, which was unfortunate. But I think we have enough distance, enough history now, and enough opportunities for collaboration that we do need to change that from such a negative tone to sort of, we have a valuable skill to offer. We can help you learn, and why not help you learn? It's not harming us. So,
Yes.
yeah, I'm sure. I don't personally know how to do it, but I'm quite certain that there are tools out there, and they're called web scrapers. So Scraper. Scraper. And I think if you look in the literature on the digital humanities, I think you'll find information about web scraping in the digital humanities. There's a lot of especially government things. There's a lot of free open like it's not copyrighted material when it's government websites and things like that. It's sort of open domain, and so you don't need permission, you don't need a license sort of thing. If it's in the free open domain, you can use it. And a lot of, governments of countries that are officially bilingual will have a lot of that information. It's a very particular text type, like you're only getting government stuff, but it's enough to play with and to kind of start. So in the scholarly community, this is actually becoming a very active area of interest. What we're seeing is that there's a pushback now. For many years, English has been the lingua franca of scholarly publishing. And, it makes sense on the one hand to use a lingua franca because there are many benefits, but on the other hand, there are also many drawbacks. And the drawbacks are particularly for the 95% of researchers who are not native speakers of English. So, it's quite unbalanced. Just earlier this month, UNESCO issued a recommendation on open science. And one of the things that they recommended was that science should be more multilingual, that forcing all of science through a single common language leads, in some cases, to poor science and can have very detrimental effects. And so they are advocating for multilingual science, which, the problem is that multilingual and lingua franca, they each have strengths and weaknesses. The strength of one is the weakness of the other. So there's no perfect solution. But since we have seen already the downside of using a single language, a common language for science, I think people are interested in exploring whether the other option will be better, will solve some of the problems. And I think machine translation is poised to become an important part of that, but it can't be ever seen as the panacea. It's not the solution. It's not going to fix everything. But I think it can play an important role. But I think this literacy is equally important, because we're going to again be seeing scholars who are scholars of other disciplines, not translation, but scholars of everything else, who, again, why would they know how to use machine translation sensibly? Some of the challenges that we're going to face are the low domain, the low resource domain, because the more specialized our work, the fewer articles that have been written about it. You know, the purpose of research is often innovation, meaning nothing has been written about it, right? It's a brand new thing. So those are some of the challenges that we're going to have to, I think, take on if we want to really see machine translation be successful in scholarly communication. How do we build the corpora? How do we amass enough data in all the languages that we need and all the subject fields that we need? And I think it's going to require cooperation, because the other challenge of scholarly communication right now is that most of the writing is behind a paywall, right? Almost all of the journals require subscription access. The only thing that's available is the abstract, which is, you know, something, but it's not enough. It's so we're going to need collaboration from the publishing industry to make the data available for corpora in order to have something to feed the machine translation system for it to learn from. So it's definitely going to be a collaborative effort. And, you know, open access is taking off, open educational resources, open publishing. So that might help a lot. If we could have more people publishing in open access, that data becomes available for systems such as machine translation. And this, I was just really, really interested by this recommendation from UNESCO just this month that, you know, we need to, they framed it in a way of inclusion, right? To make science more inclusive, we need to have more multilingual science, that we can't expect everyone to, on top of learning their discipline, also to become not just so-so English speakers, but like really high level English speakers who can, you know, write academic articles. And it's just not reasonable. So to make science more inclusive, it basically turns a lot of people off. People who might be really good scientists, but who don't want to be at a conference presenting in English, you know, having to read everything all the time in English, having to pay for their work to be translated in English, having to have everything take three times as long because they're doing it in another language, right? Like, it's not an inclusive model. And so if we can get away from English or any, it just happens to be English, but a lingua franca model for science and towards a multilingual model. And when I say science, I mean like research. I don't just mean pure and natural sciences. I mean just all types of research, yeah. Does that answer your question? I feel like I went off on a kind of a rant there, but I was so excited by the UNESCO declaration. Yeah.
Yeah,
time to wrap up.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much again for the invitation to speak and for the great participation and interaction. It was lovely. Thank you. Mm-hmm.